Well, you should have your Bibles open to Romans chapter 13 and verses 11 through 14. And again, we may cut this a little bit short today because we've got a board meeting, so we'll see how it goes. But what we're doing today is, as we've gone through, as I said in the first session, and I've tried to follow the pattern of godly edifying, and we've dealt with the pre-doctrinal exhortation that was back there in Proverbs 4. We've dealt with the transition and the naturalness for this now to become an issue of the fact that we are now going to get some instruction. Our final component of instruction of judgment is going to really focus upon the issue of making godly judgments in connection with time, and how we spend time and how we view time and how that's going to make a material difference in our sonship lives, because some things get kicked up a notch from here on out, and that we alluded to a little bit last time, as he says there, and in the first session we broke down the godly thinking and the conduct and behavior and the labor. The godly thinking and that knowing the time. There's some things we know about time already, but he's going to add some information to that, and we're to perceive some more things about time, that now it is high time to wake out of sleep, for now is our salvation nearer than when we believed. The night is far spent, the day is at hand. And the transition there is, he then goes to the let us issues, where you begin doing something in light of that. In view of that, let us therefore cast off the works of darkness. Let us put on the armor of light. A negative and a positive. Cast off the works of darkness. We need to know what those works of darkness are. And those aren't just random things. It's not just left to chance or whatever you think is the most horrible thing you could possibly do. And another thing, this section almost sounds like, well, this is going to be a piece of cake. I don't mess around with works of darkness anyway. And so I cast these things off. That's no problem. Well, we'll see. We'll see. Let us put on the armor of light, the positive part, and we're going to deal again with having to now, this is needed. You don't put armor on when you don't need it. You're going to need it, and this is going to be a needful thing where we now face soldiering for the first time. We face, as sons, having to now enter into battle, and this is an aspect of our Father's business we haven't even been qualified for up to this point. But now we will, because of some aspects that have to do with the kind of armor we're going to be putting on and what we were alerted to, that judgment begins by nature doing, and when it comes to having an effect and having an impact, it has an impact of light. And our Father, by the way, God Himself, is all about light. He's crazy about light. He's clothed in light. He's bathed in light. And by the way, and I'm just going to say this to drop it in your thinking and let it sit there for a while, but light is one of the very first things that you naturally and rightly so think about when it comes to another word that is going to be very important to us, especially out in level two of our sonship education. When you get into the book of Ephesians especially, light is the first thing that comes to your mind when you think about this word, glory. And one of the things we're going to get a complete readjustment and training and renewing of our minds about is the issue of glory. Glory is going to become a big thing, and it's going to have a massive amount of understanding that goes into it, and it's going to start to be more than just a nebulous, ethereal, kind of undefinable thing. But our Father is all about glory. And by the way, that's the next step beyond pleasure. You do things to God's honor, to His pleasure, to His pleasing, and He says that is glorious. That is my glory. And we get to begin to share in that. Now I'm getting way beyond things that where we are right now. But donning armor of light is not just simply armor for protection. That's an odd expression. Armor of light. Doesn't most of the armor that our men wear, isn't most of it camouflaged? Isn't most of the armor that our troops put on designed to better hide them from the enemy? You know, the uniforms that our soldiers wear today are kind of kooky looking uniforms, if you think about it, from the way they were when we were kids, you know, back in the days of Vietnam, and for some of you all the way back to World War II, and Cecil all the way back to Civil War. But the it's like, what did I do to deserve that? But, you know, we learn to camouflage and that kind of thing. And really the, you know, so-called scientists and everybody has figured out better patterns of desert-like camouflage. And so if you look at the uniforms up close today, they kind of resemble like badly, you know, almost the old dot matrix computer printout of various shades of tan. But from a distance, they're designed to give a camouflage effect, and there's more science and technique involved in the camouflage. But here, your father says, okay, you're going to go into battle. You're going to need some armor. Here, put it on. You say, well, wait a minute. This brightens me up. It just lights me up. Are you sure this is what you want me to wear? Yep. That's what I want you to wear. That's what I wear. That's what my son wears. When Jesus Christ comes back, he's going to come back as a flaming fire. He's going to come back resplendent. In fact, it's interesting, when you see Jesus described in the book of the Revelation, and you see John describing his armor and his battle attire, and then he'll describe, say, Michael, the archangel, and he'll describe, they're very, very similar. That's because they're on the same team. I mean, you take a five-star general and a buck private, not that Michael's a buck private, but you take a five-star general and a buck private, and if they're in their BDUs, their battle dress uniforms, outside of the rank that you might be able to see, they're similar. And so there's similarity there. And some people confuse the two, but they're not to be confused. But the fact of the matter is, there's no hiding the issue of what's going on here. We're not hiding anything. We're to be making an impact. And this isn't so much of a defensive combat. This is an offensive campaign. We're casting off works of darkness. We're doing something to intelligently and deliberately cause the adversary to have to respond to it. We're making, it's almost like Paul coming along as he did on those three occasions, or even going back to Abraham, that gesture that he made, shaking his raiment off and this kind of thing. And that happened and occurred even in Israel's program. And that gesture is designed to provoke. And there is a provoking that's going to go on naturally. We're not going to go out and like poke the adversary with a stick. But we're not going to hide what's going on. It's going to be done with armor of light. And so there's a magnificence of us beginning to get ready for this battle, to enter this arena finally, not to be sitting on the sidelines, as one guy said, sitting on the promises and instead of standing on them, you know, like the old song. But we're going to actually be in the fight ourselves. Well, let's begin looking kind of at a bird's eye view of this overall passage, and I want to get at least one major thing across this morning as we begin to kind of not look at the details of it, but kind of get in that plane and fly over it, get the bird's eye view of it in general, and look at the whole thing, how it's designed to effectually work. And for the next Bible class or two, that's what we're going to spend our time on how does this whole thing effectually work here in Romans 13, 11 through 14, or what I might call just simply getting ready for the details of it. Because there's some getting ready that needs to take place because of how big of an issue this is. And just by reading over this second component of judgment, you should easily be able to see and appreciate it's all designed to materially affect the way in which you perceive time. Now, that's not all it is, but that's part of it. It's designed to materially change your thinking in the way in which you perceive time, but especially on a particular issue about it. It's to materially change a particular issue with you, or if it's there, to now bring it front and center and say, this is where this is going to have to start. And it's all in regard to time. And you know, time is a funny issue. You talk about time, people talk about time all the time. And it's going to be hard, I've already found, to teach this without making unintended puns all the time. Because time is going to be the issue. But you know, you get into people's use of time. Time is dealt with on so many levels, and then you get into the scientific realm, and time is different when you're up high, and gravity has an issue on time, and we're not going to get into all this. But I do find it fascinating, not that I understand it by any means, but it's interesting that all these issues change as you get into the creature, as you get into the realm of the heavenlies, the second heaven, where the celestial realm, things get changed out there. Properties are different. Things move differently, and time is even experienced differently, and all those kinds of things. I find that all fascinating. But this is getting down to where you and I live. And one of the things that I'm after here, and the particular thing, when you hear him say, when you hear God tell and have it through the Apostle Paul tell us, that knowing the time, that now it is, you know, anytime somebody comes along and says it's high time for something, that sets a particular tone. It is high time to wake out of sleep, for now is our salvation nearer than when we believed. And then especially that phrase, the night is far spent, the day is at hand. Every word of that is designed to drive at a particular issue about time. And what I'm after here is that first and foremost, there's going to be several of these, but this is the first one, is the issue of perceiving. Well, before I tell you, what does it do to you when you hear that? When somebody uses words like, it's high time to awake out of sleep, now is our salvation nearer than when we believed, the night is far spent, the day is at hand. I mean, what's the tone of that? Urgency, imminence, importance, all those are good. You're on the nine ring. Immediacy, that's good. You're all right. Those are all right. There's nothing wrong in them. But I think we can get a word that takes all those things and hits the ten ring. Yeah, there's expectation. What? Precedence? We'll talk about that when we go home. I'm not sure what you mean by that. Precedence? Okay. Well, you're all far more intelligent than I am. But all those things that you said drive at this one issue. When it comes to your dad, your father, telling you these things, it's the issue of seriousness. You're going to take time more seriously than you ever did, including its importance and its immediacy, all of the things that you just said about it. But it's driving at that issue of perceiving now the seriousness of time. This takes a serious tone. And all those other things, don't think for one moment that what you said was wrong. What you said was right on. But I think it can all be gathered together under that kind of broader issue of the seriousness. And what I'm after especially is, and what the Father's going to look for, when I was talking about in our last session, when like if you were in that, where were we? We started in a blacksmith shop, then we went to a bakery or a pastry chef. I was trying to hit everybody. Even I'd like that. But in your father's business, you've only been working with him like 2 hours a day, and then he dismisses you and you go home. And so your time of your day is spent doing other things. But there comes a time now where your father says, you know what? You and I are going to start getting into a more serious aspect of business together. You've been operating now with wisdom, with justice, with some discretion, even with a little bit of judgment now. But now I'm going to need you to work with me more hours during the day, son. And the son looks at the father and he doesn't go, oh, no, where will I ever fit Nintendo into this? And that kind of thing. If that takes place, there's something seriously wrong in us that goes all the way back to Romans 6. But what really should happen is the son's sitting over there and he's got his broom and he's been brooming out, he's been doing some of the lower level works, and every day when his dad dismisses him, his tail is kind of dragging because he knows that his dad is getting ready for the really good part of the work, and I can't really work with him in it and yet. And now all of a sudden you've got to the point where you've got skill sets that have developed, you've got some experience with them, and instead of just sitting there and you're sweeping the floor out, your father says, son, come here. And he says, I want you to begin working more with me. And it's almost like you can even hear the broom drop and the handle hit the ground as you run to your father and you say, good, show me what to do. And the father comes along and he says, well, we're going to not only do more business together, we're going to be able to produce more together. You're going to have more capacity now to work with me, but you're going to be engaged in some areas of the business that you didn't even know about. You're going to get engaged in some areas. You know, I'm not the only business there is out there. And there's competitors. And you and I are going to start taking on some of these competitors. And that's what's going to happen. That's why you're going to be putting on armor of light. And why the first time in your Christian life, it's going to be necessary for you to put armor on. So what I'm after is that you appreciate, and we need to address it, the seriousness of time. Because that is going to set your attitude. And what sonship education is about, largely, is attitude. And this is designed to you and I to be able to come along with that seriousness of time and perceive the seriousness of our attitude towards our own sonship life. And I'm going through this carefully because I know I know where some of the pitfalls can occur, and for the first time of having to be in a position to get the kind of resistance and opposition that we'll face, it can be devastating if not properly prepared for, and if properly prepared for, will be glorious. And so but the one thing that you have to do is kind of turn introspective for a moment. And to be able to check yourself out as to the seriousness of your attitude toward your sonship life. Because that's kind of what the son would do from the time he was kind of sweeping the floor to when the father pulls him over and says, you're going to spend 4 hours a day with me or 5 hours a day with me. Well, the son now has to make a decision. I had the same thing happen in that natural world setting. I don't know, but maybe four or five people in this place realize it or not. But when Bob Robinson first called me to be the pastor of this church, the day he called me, and the very first time we ever talked, and we talked for, I don't know, you know Bob, he would talk for a long time, and we talked for an hour or two on the phone. I hung that phone up, and 15 minutes after I hung that phone up, now I'd been out of the ministry for exactly a year. I'd quit the church in Indiana. I had been now in the printing world, and I rose quickly in it for some strange reason. And I say strange because I'm not the mechanically minded one in the family, but for some reason I took to printing like a duck takes to water, and it all made sense. And I could do the maintenance on these great big presses, and I was fairly good at it, and rose in ranks. 15 minutes after I hung up the phone talking to Bob Robinson, I got a phone call from my old newspaper offering me a position there, a white-collar position, of, I had been the press room foreman there. They wanted me to become the production manager. And then that was a sure thing. This church, it was the first time I'd ever talked to him. You guys didn't even know if you wanted to be a church or not. There was a lot of ifs. And so there I was. I had two different jobs that I was looking at. One was an absolute sure thing that they would take me. They were going to send me to college. They were going to train me in computers and all this kind of business. The other was as unsure as it gets, this church here in Raleigh. So I don't know if you know this or not. I told the guy who offered me the publisher of the newspaper. I told him I'd take that job. I don't know if you know this or not, but I took a job before I came here that was to be my career. And when I hung that phone up, his name was Don Hurd, and I told Don, I said, well, I'll take it, because it was going to be a lot more money. We were living in a two-bedroom apartment with three children, and my entire library was in our bedroom. There was a love triangle underneath us. Guy broke the door down, shot the kneecap of the other lover off. We had, you ever seen Jungle Book and the colonel with his elephants? They all lived above us. So we were not in a very good position. And it was very tempting and alluring, boy, to take that job, go back up to northern Indiana. And I hung the phone up. I told Don I'd take it. I'd take the job. It was more money. I'd be able to get my kids out of there from being either shot below or trampled above. And we'd get back up to the same area that we had just moved from a year before. And I'd take this position with more money and be able to have more for my family. And I hung the phone up. And the minute I hung that phone up, Cindy looked at me and she said, you know, Mark, in all our lives, we've never gone backwards. And for the first time ever, we would be moving backwards. And I knew when I hung that phone up, I'd made the wrong decision. That's the story of my life. I always make the wrong one first, and then I have to straighten it out. And I called him back, and I told him, and I said, Don, I had to make a decision right there. Either I was going to I was either going to be a pastor who happened to work on the side, or I was going to be a pressman or a newspaper man who happened to teach a Bible study once in a while. That was the critical moment. And I called Don back and I said, I'll tell you what, if I did take this job, I'd still be looking for a church. And I said, I couldn't guarantee you that I'd be gone in 6 months. And that's not fair to you. And it's not fair to me, because I'm not going to be a newspaper man my whole life. I want to be, my desire is to be a pastor. And he appreciated it. He said, I understand. We knew each other. He said he understood. It wasn't a problem. I just hated it that I told him I'd take it, but I didn't leave it there. I think I called him that same day. And I went with Bob Robinson. As crazy as that sounded. I can't even believe what my parents were thinking I was doing at the time. But the point of that little story is, once again, in the kind of natural world in which we live, we've all kind of come to those points where we have to get real serious. This is a point that's far greater even than that. This has to do with our sonship lives, where when it comes to the time we spend, there's things I've already said that should have started the process in your mind. Well, if these principles, if sayings are going to have to be worked, well, that means I'm going to have to work at them. And if I'm going to have to work at something, that takes time. So there's going to be some things in my day and some things about my life that are going to start changing when it comes to this, but it starts that it would be futile for me to stand up here and try and preach some sermon. I used to do it. You know, you preach this great sermon, boy, you think you really kicked their tails on that one. Boy, you just had a great message there where, you know, you got to dedicate. And some churches have these dedication services or ceremonies or cemeteries. And the people drag their carcass down there and they dedicate and they rededicate and they re-rededicate. And sometimes they'll baptize, they'll rebaptize you and re-rebaptize you. I don't know if they have two separate places. You know, this is the first timers, and this is, you know, the other one's a little dirtier. It's the ones for the guys that have to, you know, well, this is his fourth time getting back. I was at a service once where a guy went forward for rededication, and I asked him how many times he'd done it. He said four times. He said, that's nothing. I've been saved 12 times. And he meant justified saved. I'm like, I don't even know where to begin with that, you know. But that's the way his preacher kept making him feel, that every time he got sinful and backslid, he lost his salvation. So he had to come back down and get saved. Then he had to come back again and get rededicated and then rebaptized. That poor guy was just confused, as can be. But there's an attitude that's supposed to have developed where you no longer are going to begin viewing time the way you viewed it before. The seriousness of it now, it's not a thing where, as I say, you can just come along and try to preach a dedication or a commitment to time, or a commitment to these sayings, or a commitment to your sonship life, and it isn't going to work. None of those, I don't care how great the sermon is, how marvelously worded it is, and how clever the thoughts and the words and the points and the outline and the summation and the poem at the end all works. It won't do a thing. At best, it's just a temporary feeling that wears off once Monday morning sets in. But what you're going through is different than that. And what you and I are going through are things that, if these things are working well, they don't just do one thing. They begin other processes going. And one of the processes that should be going is that this is going to demand more time. And I don't mean by that that you're going to quit your... One day we're going to wind up all quitting our jobs, putting on bed sheets, and going to Grandfather Mountain waiting for Jesus to come back. That's not what I'm talking about. But I am saying that you have to evaluate in the details of your life that in order to make some judgments that are of the godly nature, it's going to demand more of your time. And time takes on a seriousness here, but more than that, it makes it so you evaluate your attitude toward your own sonship life from here on out. Because this is not just a temporary battle, and that'll be over, and then it's just going to be peaches and cream until death or the rapture. This is the beginning of a lifelong fight and battle. As you begin to display more and more light and have more and more of an impact, and you become more and more conformed to the image of Christ, who I don't care what the news media, the hippies, and Hollywood say, would be hated, despised, and murdered today as quickly as he was when he was here on this earth. And you're being conformed into that image, not just the image of Christ as he was under Israel's program, but the image of Christ as he now exists in his thinking and the thrust of his whole life as it exists in this dispensation of grace and for what this dispensation of grace is about. And we're getting ready to take back from the adversary a far greater field of the creation than just the earth. Far greater. The whole heavenly realm. People look up there today and they say, well, I don't know how it could be so big and not have something out there. Read your Bible. Something is out there. We're not alone. Never have been. These cuckoo clocks that go running around calling themselves professors, you know, that's what a professor is. He just professes things. That's where the word professor came from. And check that out in some of the passages in the Bible. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools. That's where a professor came from. He's one who professes himself to be wise. We're going to be taking on areas and realms that are that when it comes to the adversary, he could almost give up the earth. He's got the whole rest of the heavenly realm. And we're getting ready. This is what our lives are going toward. This is the seriousness of it. Well, that's part of what I wanted to get across here. Not only does everything get, you know, just the terminology, it's time to wake out. Everything gets kicked up a notch as far as your increased ability and your increased capacity for making godly judgments that are God-pleasing decisions. And your impact is going to get kicked up a notch. But also, the opposition and resistance is going to get kicked up a notch as well. And along with all of that, another thing that's supposed to, the Father is supposed to look at the Son and see if it's there. That's part of what that checkpoint was for that we went through, is to see that your attitude, an increase in your attitude toward your sonship life has taken place. Now, like I say, when the Father calls on you to spend time with Him in these endeavors, it's not reluctant, it's enthusiastically. The truth of the matter is, that son who's been pushing that broom couldn't be waiting more for that day when the Father says, I want to increase your time with me. You get it, almost hear him, you know, okay, Dad. And then when the day's over, when he goes out the door, you hear him shouting. Woo-hoo! Couldn't wait for that to take place. That's something that you need to think about in your own life. And even though at the beginning of our sonship education we had by the effectual working way back there, I want you to think back now for a minute, all the way back to Romans 8, 14 and 15. Sonship orientation, sonship establishment, Romans 8, 16 through the end of chapter 8. Back there we got a lot. We talked a lot about godly zeal. The time that you first are told, and you knew it was coming, but you it wasn't a surprise. But then you came to the point of the pinnacle, the capstone of your whole sanctified position in Christ, your adoption as a son. You cried, Abba, Father. You had zeal, enthusiasm for that. And then to get the education, what the sonship establishment did to increase that zeal and enthusiasm to get our sonship education going. And even though when in chapter 12 in verses 1 and 2 we presented ourselves, our bodies, to our Father with all that proper commitment level to it, getting our sonship education underway, the truth of the matter is, with all of these things growing and growing that I just mentioned that get kicked up a notch, the truth of the matter is, the level of intensity that we possessed for the zeal, enthusiasm, ambition, the delight of getting our sonship education, that's not to stay at that level. It's not designed to stay at that level. Even though you couldn't have imagined how you could be any more enthusiastic and zealous and so forth than it was back then. The truth is, God designed it to grow and grow and ever be growing greater and greater and greater. And the only way that could take place is to come along and do what He did, to get it to a level and then begin educating you. And as He begins to educate you, you get a taste of it. You get some experience with that sonship liberty to be able to make wise decisions and just decisions and then start curtailing it through the godly love and charity that's being developed and making some judgmental decisions. You're getting a taste of that. You've got a good taste of it now, of what your sonship education is like. And you've got a taste of what it's like to get the effectual working of that education going. In other words, it took that. It took play, that increased zeal takes place when you finally get a real down-to-earth, day-to-day, not theoretical, rubber-meet-the-road grasp of how this doctrine works itself out in the details of my life. And that separates us, folks. I mean, that's different from the way, that's not just taking a three-point sermon and a poem and then being able to, I don't know what you do, you just put it in a notebook somewhere and it really doesn't do a whole lot for you. And it's certainly not compartmentalized systematic theology like we used to teach. This all is all connected and has a continual outworking within us, through us, and it's supposed to work out. And that gives you a taste of what this is like, and finally getting the experience of it working out in the details of our lives and what the doctrine is both doing with us, and it does things with us, because there's labor and conduct and behavior involved, and it does things within us. It renews our mind. You're not what you are now as you were 6 months or a year or 2 years ago simply because you're older. But in a real godly edifying way, you're not any longer what you are because you've been properly going through the curriculum with its step-by-step process, first things first, sense and sequence issue, and you're beginning to match your father in the way he thinks, the way he lives, the way he works. So I'm bringing that back into the forefront. I know you don't know it, but I'm bringing it back up because it's a real issue in the effectual working of these four verses. We've got some experience of the grandeur of our... And I've heard some of you express that. That's why I listen more even at the times that we have some interactivity for your comments. And I've heard some of you express, even as timid as some of you are, you'll express how great this is and how grand it is and how glorious it is, how magnificent it is. And that's all a part, that's good, because that gives an indication of the delight that you have. And because of that, the ambition, the delight, the zeal and enthusiasm really does or should intensify. After all, folks, it's a love affair. It's what it is. When you get to this point, there's an expected measure of that. The father expects, it's one of the things, the exhortations. They're not just following exhortations, they're following expectations. And one of the expectations that we had, in fact, why don't you flip back there real quick. I'm going to try to do this, and I don't know if I'm going to be able to finish it all up or not, but we'll see. Yeah, I should be able to. Let's flip back to Proverbs 4, but look at that exhortation that took place prior to even... begin at the checkpoint exhortations there in verses 1 through 9 of chapter 4. And all I'm after, we're not going to go back and cover any of this, I'm just giving you an opportunity to see it with your own eye there. But part of the expectation of those first 9 verses, and maybe we didn't bore in on it as much as we should have back then, but we're going to do that now, there's an expectation the Father has to get judgment. That your zeal, enthusiasm, delight for your sonship life, for just being a son and a daughter of your father, for being in that adopted status, for having a capstone given to your sanctified position in Christ that allows you the vehicle to take what it means to be dead to sin, alive unto God, and put it in, it answers the yearning of your heart's desire back there in Romans 6, to walk in newness of life, to take the grace that saved you and justified you and utilize it in walking in newness of life. And something that has been latent back there in your mind and you've never put it down, you've never forgot it, is to be able to produce fruit unto holiness that God would accept, that has everlasting life to that fruit. It won't die and wither away on the vine. It's fruit your Father, you can actually pick it and it won't die. And your Father will pick it and he'll put it up around him. He wants it around him forever. He's delighted with that fruit of holiness. All those kinds of things have been generating that zeal and enthusiasm. And it's grown to the point where now the Father comes along, and before you and him enter into really doing more, spending more time together and more time aspects of the Father's business, you've actually got some information of an expected nature for the intensification of the zeal for your sonship life to be taking place. And that's part of this checkpoint back here in Proverbs chapter 4. Notice here that you're told something. All I want is verses 8 and 9. Verses 8 and 9. When it came to wisdom and the kind of things that he says there about wisdom, and it's the principal thing and get it and all those kinds of things. We focused a lot on that when we first went through it. But when it comes to wisdom, which really all that you're getting is your father's wisdom, and your sonship education, notice there in verse 8, you are to exalt her. Notice these words of intensification, exalt her, and she shall promote thee. She shall bring thee to honor when thou dost embrace her. She shall give to thine head ornament of grace, a crown of glory. Glory comes up there. Shall she deliver to thee? What I'm after there, there's a couple of expressions that you're doing something with her. It's like wisdom is personified. It's like the curriculum for your sonship life becomes personified. It's like you could, if you took all the words of Paul from Romans through Philemon or Romans through 2 Thessalonians, and they're just letters and words out here, and all of a sudden they take the shape, for me as a man, of a woman. They become personified. And the Father says, exalt her. Embrace her. Folks, as wisdom gets personified, you're to fall ever deeper and ever deeper in love with her. She becomes the love of your life. And it's a lot like a man. I can remember, and I know using personal examples are old and passe, but I can remember the first time I ever touched Cindy. I remember the first time I ever touched her. At first, you're just, you know, you're across the room. And that was enough. And, of course, I was coming very shortly out of adolescence. I was just making the transition out of girls are yuck, cooties, and all of that kind of business. I mean, we started actually kind of dating, puppy love type stuff, when we were like 15 years old. That's pretty early. Our first date, neither one of us could drive. Her mom had to drive us to the pizza place. And in the car, you know, she's smashed against that door and I'm smashed against this one. And you were content with that for a while. But there's a point, as love begins to generate, there's a point where you're no longer content to just be in the same room, but your love is, because it's designed to intensify, you want to move closer to her. And then you want to maybe hold hands. You're touching now. And then there'll come a point where you're going to want to embrace, hug. Now it's becoming even more intimate. Well, we're going to leave the analogy there. But the point of the matter is that there's supposed to be a growing intensification of the love relationship that we're having with our sonship education. This shouldn't be scary or daunting. You should love this. This is what I was ever created for. I wasn't created to be a printer. I was created to be useful in my father's business. I wasn't created, fill in the blank for your job. That is a useful thing and a good thing for you to do. But it's not the primary reason you have a body. That body is to be engaged even in the work you do in your occupation. And we've got information already about it. To not be slothful in business, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord. So we're not going to make stupid mistakes here and say, oh, this is teaching me I have to quit my job. No, it's not. If you get that out of that, you are not only mistaken, you're nuts. So we get that out of the way first and foremost. But there is to be a love growth that is taking place in intensifying your relationship with your whole sonship education. And the Father's looking for that here. He's expecting. That's why he says the things about wisdom here. Exalt her. Embrace her. She's going to bring thee to honor. There's going to be some promotion here. The Father's looking for that seriousness about time and the son's own ratcheted up enthusiasm, attitude, and delight for his education. And he's expecting that to be taking place. The truth of the matter is, those initial commitment levels that we had, and we're really out of time, so I'm not going to go to the charts. I had the old charts on them. But the commitment levels that we first had, and I might start here on Wednesday night, that dealt with your initial commitment to honest attendance and so forth and so on, all has a direct bearing upon our godly thinking in connection with time. All the way back then. Because if you consider what's being said to you in Romans 13 and just verse 11, and that knowing the time, there's something we already know about time, but Paul isn't just coming along again and reminding us about that issue. He's actually providing us with information that if everything we already have gone through, if everything we already know about time, and working effectually within us as God designed it to work, which includes the issue of our zeal, enthusiasm, ambition, delight, and so forth for getting our education even further along than it is already, then that means that we're going to have more insightful understanding. We're going to have more clarity and perception and appreciation for the valuing with respect to time than we've ever had before. In other words, this isn't designed, as I said, to merely come along and make you appreciate the time as a fleeting thing and as a precious commodity. That's there. I'm not saying it's not. I'm not saying it that way to say it's not there. Truth is, it is. But that should have actually come out of our understanding of time from Romans 6. That's what we already know. Nor are we merely recognizing that time is something we could easily waste. That came out of our sanctification from long ago. Rather, now we're going to look at time and we're going to see something more intense about it in connection with it. And that's what you need to begin kind of evaluating in your own heart and asking your own self, if your personal evaluation of time has changed at all. I'm not looking for it to be like, wow, it's just entirely, but that you can look back and you can see. And I know some of you can. I know the answer for most of you already, because I've heard you say it. Even from the people who come up and say, you know, I don't think I'm ever going to live long enough to ever see the end of Romans or these kinds of things. Well, something is pressing you in the issue of time. And that's what needs to be changing, because the love affair with your sonship education should be growing, and it's exactly the same thing as the love affair with your girlfriend, boyfriend, husband, wife. The more you fell in love and the more that love grew, the less time you had for anyone else. The more time you wanted to spend together. And I don't mean to hurt anybody's feelings when I say this, but I'm going to say it anyway. And I'm saying this to ward off anyone wanting to counsel with me. It does not compute or register with me when somebody says, I'm married, but I want my time, and he gets his time. He gets boy time with the boys. I get my time with me and my girls. My time, his time. That may sit well with you. Fine. Go right at it. But if you get trouble when that's occurring and you want to come to me about it, remember, it doesn't compute with me. When I have any time at all to myself, the only person I want around me is my wife. I want to spend my time with her. That's grown. I want that more now than when we were dating. I don't want to go up to going on a fishing excursion or something with the boys, that's okay, but it would be so much better if Cindy were there. First, she outfishes me. Second, she can take more being on the water without puking than I can. Everything I do, I want to do with her. That's my first thought. If we go somewhere, I want to go there with her. And it's not just because, oh, that's such a Hallmark sentiment. It's just because that's the nature of love ever growing. And that parallels what should be taking place here. That your love affair with this curriculum and with your sonship life should change the way you think about time. And your father now is going to address you with some information. If all that's working, this is going to pick up and hook and attach onto that, and it's going to open up an entire new vista for you. That's what's going on here. That's part of the effectual working of what this is going to do. So, we're out of time. In fact, I should have quit 5 minutes ago. And Cindy sits out there. She, being a pastor's wife, she has to sit there and endure all the, oh, there goes Mark again. And I can just see her sinking down when talking about when we were dating and loving and all this kind of business and this kind of thing. And it's just part of the burden that a pastor's wife has to carry. And pastor's children have to carry that from time to time, too. And talk about Sarah or Luke or Andrew or somebody along those lines. And they, oh, no, here we go. Don't want a dad's stories. But anyway, well, hopefully you can think about that. Think about yourself in connection with your own evaluation of time. And look back from Romans 6 and see if that perspective and that seriousness and that love affair has been there and been growing, and that you feel very comfortable with your father now boring in on this issue of time and how we're going to begin spending it in a new vista that opens up of our sonship lives with him. And hopefully those things are there to the point where you say, yeah, it's almost like you're going to cry Abba Father all over again, which is fine. But that's the nature of finally getting into the battle, finally getting into the conflict, no longer talking about it, but actively engaging it. So that's where we are. Well, we'll stop right there and we'll pick this up on Wednesday night and further deal with the effectual working of the overall passage, and then we'll get into, of course, the details. So with our heads bowed, Heavenly Father, again, we're grateful to have